recorded history, but they're not to be found. And we feel it's terribly important to take a moment to honor these women and to make a commitment that the rest of us will be heard.
Suggest the following myths are basic in the culture of oppression.
give my reaction to this culture. Myth number one, there is a separation of mind, rational, and emotions, irrational. The mind is of higher value than emotion. The objective is more valuable than the subjective. This concept of separation or division of oneself allows for objectification of oneself and sets the stage for us to be programmed into beliefs of right or wrong. Traditionally, women are labeled emotional, irrational, less than adequate. To be adequate, women must become attached to men or be male positioned, rational, logical. This concept of separation cuts me off from the very source my strength, my feelings. Feelings that can tell me what is most important in my life, and who I am, and how I wish to spend my time working, loving, nurturing, and developing myself. Feelings tell me how to use our technical knowledge in the service of myself and others, rather than allowing me to be destroyed by it. Myth number two. We are defined by external factors and values, and our self-worth depends on our conforming to these external factors. Inherently, we are bad, and therefore must be controlled. The need to conform and be the same is of high priority in sustaining this myth. If I were to believe in this value, I would use large reservoirs of energy trying to be sure of how I am to be defined in our society. Woman, heterosexual, mother, nurturer of men, less than a person unless married, thin, white, beautiful. What's inside me, in my person, that doesn't match society's external definition must be denied or destroyed. This pulls me off center and alienates me from myself and teaches me to hate myself. This I cannot do and will not do. Myth number three. White people are inherently superior to black people. Men are inherently superior to women. Heterosexuality is inherently superior to homosexuality. Racism, sexism, and homophobia are the holy trinity of our Western culture. They are worshipped in the church of economic institutions. These insidious forces are held together by greed, self-hate, the union of pain and pleasure, Protestant work ethic, economic oppression, basic inability to deal with difference. The institutions of society, the family, the law, court, government, business, the educational system, the arts, social, medical, and mental health bureaucracies, these institutions perpetuate and maintain this myth. When I was able to understand my participation in the subtle, therefore more insidious forms of the value system that is constructed to support these myths, I began to fight my way free. Unfortunately, lesbians have often been as guilty as other members of society in perpetuating and practicing racism, sexism, and homophobia. We no longer need to do this. Myth number nine. Acceptance and participation in the mainstream of society is automatically desirable. In order to be accepted, you may have to compromise important personal values because average middle American values are most important. You have to play the game. This myth is most dangerous to the lesbian and gay community. The valid need not to be oppressed in housing, employment, civil rights, etc., tempts us to present ourselves as, quote, respectable, and really like everyone else, just misunderstood. We are not the same as anyone else. We must not abandon our differences for the sake of stopping oppression and hostility. Our sexual statement is more than a choice of physical relationship. It is a fabric of ourself, a statement of an integrated ego. It has been hard won under hostility and violence, should not be surrendered for the bittersweet taste of acceptance by the system. The system is willing to let us into the fringes of society in order to silence us. Indeed, we should maintain our differences even if we are accepted and credentialed by all the institutions in society. Our strength rests in keeping our outer image identical to our inner struggles and statements of self. If the choice is external oppression or denial of self, I would choose the former. I feel strongly that there are other alternatives to oppression. The understanding that difference is the life force of each of us will lead us to these options. Thank you. misunderstanding and portrayal of the disabled women acquiescing in their own destruction is clearly criticizing the social conditions which seem to require the acquiescence, and, more importantly, she is criticizing our participation in that acquiescence. And Susan Yankovic's silent witness in its affirmation of survival for women is, by implication, a strong indictment against self-destruction. A brilliant, moving novel, Silent Witness is told from the point of view of a 37-year-old deaf-mute woman who slowly moves from a position of utter impotence in a world where she observes brutality and cannot even report it, much less stop it, to a position of autonomy, working, loving, and living with other women in a women's prison. Her deaf-mute impotence is a painfully accurate metaphor for women's position in this culture, while the women's prison is a metaphor for a women's community, cut off from the larger society, and because of that, one which allows women to come. But Morrison's and Yankovic's are relevant voices, and the other novels using suicide content, not only is the suicide, whether literal or figurative, not criticized, it is often couched in such terms that we are invited to accept the character's sacrifice as the only possible action. For example, in Diane Johnson's The Shadow Knows, the tension in the novel results from our expectation that the character will be murdered, and when she is, quote, only raped. A sigh of relief, not quite noticing that in that escape she gives up everything that which had made her life painless. She will survive because she now knows enough to look in the garage before getting out of the car. But she survives as only a, quote, shadow. Lois Gould's A Sea Change is even trickier. Because the novel describes a woman who appears to be taking control of her own life, this is one thing to read, appears to be taking control of her own life, who encourages her two daughters to do likewise, all imaged well through her first taking over her husband's mistress, and then the poor women coming through as lone survivors of a hurricane. We must read the novel very carefully to see that her survival is at the expense of her being herself. We must continually remind ourselves that she is in fact a male rapist, and that this is not a community of strong men, but another patriarchal male. Yet, both because the protagonist begins as victim, and because all female characters seem to be taking control of their lives, they respond positively to their apparent success, which obscures the suicidal means by which it is achieved. The question all of these novels raise is why? Why do women persist in creating images of their own destruction? The novels present intelligent, extremely effective analyses of how women acquiesce in a culture that relies on doing so. Yet despite their analysis of women's acquiescence, the tradition persists, even to the point of inviting our acceptance of it. The question becomes, why do we continue to participate in our own destruction when we understand so well the reasons for our doing so? And the question applies not only to the novelists and their protagonists, but also to critics writing about these novels. For the novelist, perhaps it is limitations inherent in the condition of the novel, plus the corresponding restrictions imposed by commercial publication. But what about the critics? I have received the most scathing attack of my career from a women's journal in response to a paper observing the self-destructive mode of contemporary women's novels, labeled as, quote, positive role model criticism, full of, quote, snarls and sneers directed against women. The paper is judged offensive. The implication is that to assume there might be some other mode for women apart from self-destruction is offensive, and it is offensive to women. I am not at all sure that it is as offensive as it is threatening. The snarls and sneers of my respondent's letter sound much more like they are coming from feelings of threat than from, quote, feelings of feminist outrage. one of us trained by and working for the institutions of that culture bears to do that. With a heterosexual critic, with her, quote, dealings with feminist outrage, there appears to her to be too much of that stake in risking disapproval. With a lesbian critic, with my dealings with feminist outrage, knowing that approval from a male-dominant culture comes only with women's acquiescence in their own destruction, there is too much at stake not to risk it. It is safer, really, not to self-destruct.
Not be reading the whole thing that I'm going to say to you, speaking from notes, etc., so bear with me when I hesitate. I would just like to say that it feels very good as alumna of Mount Holyoke College, 1969, to be standing here. I wasn't glad to be here, but I'm glad to be here now. What I'm going to try to talk about is some considerations about what Black lesbian feminist research might be. These are notes, and I think besides my own reluctance to write papers when I don't have to, is the fact that there really is no body of something called Black lesbian feminist research. This is like, I think, perhaps a theoretical discussion. I will also be reading, from the part of the introduction that I wrote to a book that will be coming out next year from the Feminist Press, whose work title is Black Women's Studies, and I co-edited with Gloria Hull of the University of Delaware and Patricia Bell Scott of the University of Tennessee. And my sense of an introduction was the politics of Black women's studies, and I'll read you some sections of that if I have time. So, to get into the notes. The first thing I wanted to say about what I think Black lesbian feminist research is that this is a new kind of thinking. Black lesbian feminist approach to learning will not shy away from the obvious conclusions that one's experiences, that our experiences, lead us to. It won't have to pretend. In other words, Black lesbian feminist scholarship, the purpose of it will not be to tell lies. It will not be to keep all persons who are not white and are male oppressed. And that's what I think that's the function of Western white males, learning to keep us oppressed. So it will be the opposite of that. One thing that will make Black lesbian feminist research new is that it simultaneously, and the key word is simultaneous, it will simultaneously not be racist, not sexist, not classist, and not homophobic. And this will be real new. This approach to knowledge, this type of analysis, has got to be new because we can assume that it is the very opposite of what white male Western thought has done. This also makes it different from much of what Black male and white female scholarship has done. It cannot be about the making of careers or elitism. It's about truth-telling. I've been reading the work of Susan Leigh Starr, who some of you might know, who was published in Centers for Wisdom. I've been reading her stuff during the last couple of weeks in a concentrated note, also with something in manuscript. I'm really quite impressed by her because what she is doing is to create a new way of thinking about thinking. And it is a lesbian feminist perspective. And I have some notes here about what she's doing to the field that that kind of thinking is the kind of thinking that we, as Black lesbian feminist research, are getting to. She's doing research on difference in female and male brain functions, thought patterns, etc., in a scientific and philosophic way. It's hard to say exactly what it is that she does. I'm sure other people have read it. think it's philosophy, I think it's theory, I think it's science, I think it's just incredible. She is trying to write theoretically and scientifically about what I and other lesbians have experienced in our lives. And from my perspective as a person who's in literature, what we have experienced as we read the new lesbian feminist writing, it is an entirely new use of language. Judy Braun, Jan Clausen, Adrienne Rich, Audre Lorde, et cetera, are creating new cognitive structures through their use of language. Just as the women's movement, politically conscious lesbian feminism always challenges received knowledge. Think of the potential then for innovation, and that's what Susan Leigh Starr's work does. Just as the women's movement, this is another characteristic of Black lesbian feminist research that I've alluded to, but I think that is a point that needs to be affirmed because it, I think, applies to many people here because of the conversation of the slogan. Just as the women's movement faces inevitable death if it does not eradicate its racism, women's and lesbian research and art will also die, be meaningless if it continues to be racist, which often means white only, as opposed to consciously making negative, statements about people of color. Feminism requires then the changing of behavior, not just the structure. That's something that we need to remember too. I think that the question of racism in the women's movement is a telling question for this stage of it. The women's movement is going to rise or fall on this issue. I think that some of the kinds of things that have happened here at this panel, I guess in particular, and some other panels, in which white women and black women are beginning to somehow have a way of speaking to each other about the shared experience of femaleness, is an indication that the women's movement is not going to fall on this issue. I think also that as our feminist activism looks at and works on issues that affect all women, like the issues of violence against women, rape, sterilization, abuse, battering, that we also will find ourselves necessarily confronting each other and learning who each other are, because we can't not do that when we're dealing with universal issues. And I feel that this is something, of course, that has to apply to the research, the so-called scholarly work that we do too. What I'm going to talk about at this point, and I don't know if these things are making sense to you. They are making a whole lot of sense to me, they are notes, and I am going quickly. And they're really, I think, very much statements, assertions as opposed to, proofs. I'm not trying to prove things, just kind of throwing them at you. We'll have time to talk about them later. What I'm going to do now is to talk about some things that I think that Black lesbian feminist research would focus upon. Like, in other words, what materials could we begin to look at in a Black lesbian feminist manner? And this is a very difficult question. How would it be different from lesbian research of lesbians who are wider of other classes? A way it would be different is that we would have to, like I say, look in different places. We would not be able to go to a Mount Holyoke or a Vassar to find enclaves of Black lesbians, for example, because of course Black women were most of the first three of these schools were not, of course, admitted in any numbers. Then, of course, there would have been some there. What we're going to need is an ability then to read between the lines. We're going to have to look at things that we didn't think were going to tell us anything about who we are. And I guess at this point, I think I'd like to talk about, perhaps, what I've been thinking of as a model for what Black lesbian research could look like in practice. And that is the Black Feminist Collective that I've been a part of for 4 years in Boston, which in itself is a